Well, hello and welcome to this edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Glad to have you with us on this. Oh, it's still kind of nasty out there, isn't it? As we traverse the streets of the city, as you listen to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station, right here in Kansas City. You could tell who the brave guests are, the hardy people, maybe from back east or spent a lot of time back east, so they're used to this kind of weather. The ballet is with us in the first half hour of the program today. Devin Carney, the artistic director of the Kansas City Ballet, is here once again. He always seems to make it, no matter how bad the weather. You must like me, I guess. I'm glad that you do. It's always nice to have you here, as a matter of fact. He is the artistic director of the Kansas City Ballet. He started in the musical city of New Orleans.
That's true.
Where he hails from. And that's what's a nice warm climate down there for the most part. Mm-hmm. A lot of rain, though.
A lot of rain.
But he moved on to places such as Boston. I'm sure they had a lot of snow in Boston. Spent some time in Cincinnati and traveling in other areas as well. He finds himself now in Kansas City, where he's been here for how many years now? 5 years? Oh, does it seem longer?
No, it seems much shorter, actually. Okay. It seems like yesterday it was the first time I came to be on your program. So it's so exciting. You know, when you're having fun, time flies.
And it's always nice to have you here. They're doing part of their 60th anniversary dance festival is going on. So you brought some guest choreographers in to talk about it. And he brought one of the best. Matthew Neenan is with us. He's the choreographer of the Even. The Uneven, one of the pieces. It is a Kansas City premiere. I guess it originally played in the area back in September at Johnson County Community College.
Correct. Yes. Yeah.
Has it changed much since you worked with it then?
Not really. I've kept the structure of the work very much the same. What's always great coming back to a piece, especially since it was just about 6 or 7 months ago, as Devin was saying earlier, it's had time to marinate and grow old a little bit. And it wasn't that long ago, so the dancers really remembered all the steps. So now they can just take it to a new, sophisticated level. I've changed some quirks. I've changed some idiosyncrasies within the piece, but structurally it's still the same, and it's great to see it get to a whole new level.
You said you expected more of them, so I guess you do. You expect improvement?
Yes, yeah, they're so talented, and they're grade A level dancers. So, and they know that as well. So they know, like, okay, let's take this to a whole new world.
Matthew has been all over the place. His training was with the Boston Ballet, among other things. You went to one of the performing arts schools in New York.
Yes, I went to LaGuardia Performing Arts High School in New York, as well as School of American Ballet.
Are those schools like they are portrayed in films and motion pictures and TV?
Not in center stage. Yes and no. Yes and no. I think they build up the drama a little bit. When I was at Performing Arts High School, we didn't dance on the tables or out on the street and stop traffic, although I do love that moment in the film. But we didn't do that. I don't think we were allowed to.
You are the choreographer in residence at the Pennsylvania Ballet.
Yes.
But they give you time away, obviously, to do other things.
Yes.
Because you have a ton of credits here, more than I can even hope to read. But I will read a few of them. Washington Ballet, Colorado, Ballet West, Memphis, Milwaukee, Oregon. Co-founded an organization called Ballet X.
Yes. Yes, I started that company about 12 years ago with a co-partner, Christine Cox. And then about 4 years ago, I stepped down as artistic director to focus on choreography. But I'm still highly involved with the company, and they do my work. And I'm just kind of focusing on creating rather than directing.
Yeah, well, thank you for being here. A lot more coming from Matthew. I have a lot of things I'd like to inquire with him about. But Devin, we want to talk about the 60th anniversary dance festival, and you're really doing a lot this time. The first weekend, you're doing 3 ballets.
Mm-hmm,
the second weekend, you're going to do 3 more ballets.
3 different ones. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. It's quite an undertaking. Something the Kansas City Ballet has never done in their 60-year history. So, you know, why not mark sort of a milestone year by doing something we've never done before? And I think it's really exciting to do 6 works In a very compact amount of time, because it's going to give the audiences here in Kansas City a chance to really see, as Matthew said, you know, the level of the artists in this company is extraordinary, and they're capable of so much. And to be able to see the broad range of diverse styles that they're able to quite proficiently be able to perform is extraordinary, and I think it's something to be relished and recognized, and we're getting that chance to see that. And it's been a huge undertaking, Michael, because we're basically producing two shows that are going to basically simultaneously go out on stage. So it's been, well, since Matthew created his work, The Uneven, back in September and then came back now, that work has been maintained along the way, keeping it going, not every single day, but we keep coming back to it since it closed in September to make sure it still has some life and that it's still breathing. And then we have other ballets that started getting staged in January with Balanchine's, George Balanchine's Diamonds. And also Petit Mort is another one that was just recently staged, which is Yuri Killian's work. And Man in Black was just concluded being staged as well, which is the work by James Kadelka with music by Johnny Cash. And also, since January, we've had another world premiere that's being created, been ongoing being created, and that's Andrea Shirmoli's work called Klein Perspectives. And then on top of that, we had another work in January stage, which was Stanton Welsh's play, which is To the Music of Moby. So all this has been going on, and it's been this sort of cyclone of different works that are spinning in the dancers' minds, you know, because they get a new stager comes in and puts together a work in 2 weeks. But in the meantime, you're being choreographed on by Andrea Shirmoli. And, oh, by the way, in the meantime, you're making sure that The Uneven, Matthew's fabulous work, is continuing to grow and mature with time. So it's a lot. It's like historic for the company.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot exciting for them to keep up on,
yeah,
as things go,
yeah,
by.
Yeah, and you know, the beautiful thing is that they're doing phenomenal work right now, and I will say that, you know, these are the kind of moments when you really discover how much you actually can do as an artist, and it helps you grow and gives you more confidence, and you go out on stage the next time feeling like, I can do this even better than I thought I could do it, you know, because you're thrust into an environment that is full of a lot of challenges, and every one of the dancers is rising to the moment. And I would strongly encourage everybody who's listening that, you know, come see both weekends. You're not going to see the whole impact of what we're doing unless you come to both weekends, because you will see completely different works on both weekends.
The first weekend, April 6th, 7 and 8, Friday the 6th, 7:30, mm-hmm. Saturday the 7th, 7:30, Sunday the 8th, an afternoon matinee at 2 o'clock p.m. Then, of course, that second weekend, well, the first weekend, Diamonds, choreographed by Balanchine. More right. on that in a moment. Petit Mort and The Uneven, Matthew's piece. That is the first weekend. Then the second weekend, the 13th, 14th, and 15th, Friday the 13th, should I even mention that? The Man in Black, with the Johnny Cash music, Klein Perspectives, you mentioned the young lady, and Play, the third one on the second
right,
weekend. So
right.
That's how it's breaking down for all of that. The 6th, 7th, and 8th, the 13th, 14th, and 15th, the second weekend. 816-931-8993 for plans or questions, or online where there is a plethora of information at kcballet.org. I like that word ever since I heard Howard Cosell start using it all
right.
the time.
So Howard Cosell.
We kind of copied the old guy.
Uh-huh.
Yes, we did. But let's talk about Diamonds. You do a lot of Balanchine. Your predecessor did a lot of Balanchine.
Yeah,
so we're
yeah.
very familiar with Balanchine
yeah.
here. And you know Balanchine's big when he's talked about in the ballet. Well, even makes it into Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm. I know. It's pretty fun when you told me that just before we went on air. Uh-huh. And it's quite fun to hear even Jerry Seinfeld's talking about Balanchine.
That's
I like
right.
that.
Now, Diamonds was part of
uh-huh.
a
larger work.
A larger
yeah,
work,
it's
yes.
Balanchine's, you know, Balanchine sadly is no longer alive. So we're working with a limited repertoire of work that to choose from to this day, but, you know, he passed in 83. And so that's, you know, 17, 18, that's, what is that, 30-some years, 31 years. But, you know, his works are still vibrant and doing quite well around the country and the world. Diamonds was his only full-length non-narrative work he ever choreographed. He actually never did a full-length other than Diamonds. Other than Jewels is the name of the full-length event, which incorporates three different sections, the first being Emeralds with music by Fauré, the second being Rubies with music by Stravinsky, and the third being Diamonds with music by Tchaikovsky. Diamonds is sort of the big conclusion, right, of the evening. It's the biggest cast of the three works on that evening program. And, you know, it was a very appropriate moment. I wanted to do Diamonds. The company's never done Diamonds, and it's a precursor to doing the full evening, I believe. I would love to present the entire Jewels somewhere down the road. But, you know, if we can get that first, that big finale concluded, the conclusion of the ballet, if we can kind of get that one in our pocket and know how to do that one, it will make the further process easier. But we're doing Diamonds also because it is our Diamond Jubilee. It is our 60th anniversary. So there's a lot of obvious reasons to be doing Diamonds in that respect. But it's the most classical of the three works within the ballet called Jewels. And it really harkens back to some of Balanchine's Russian roots. But it's such a pure work, and it's very demanding, especially on the lead couple. It's a very famous pas de deux that's done by the lead couple. And we really have the great opportunity that we have someone staging the work. It's been staged already. Judith Fugate, who... she danced the lead role, and she danced with Balanchine. So we have a really good source in what the version is we're going to be doing of this work. And I'm really thrilled about that, to have someone who had direct contact with Balanchine. And that's the best way to have a ballet restaged. So I'm thrilled about that one.
A petite mort. You already said a little about it. But.
Oh, that's Yuri Killian's work, who was the longtime director of Netherlands Dance Theater in Europe. And Yuri's work, you know, this is kind of like, you know, it's kind of like Mount Rushmore a little bit in the choreographic world, in terms of every dancer hopes that someday, you know, there's kind of this bucket list that, you know, really good dancers want to do. And in that bucket, I would say 9 times out of 10, Matthew's nodding his head. my head was nodding too. I never got to do this ballet as a dancer. I wish I could have. You did?
No, I did not.
Yeah, see, we're both like...
yeah.
Right. But it's one of those ballets that every dancer wants to have the chance to do. It's iconic. It is synonymous with Yuri Killian's name. And I cannot tell you how exciting it is to have this on the program, along with Matthew's work and Diamonds, all into one program. Oh, my goodness. You know, a world premiere, a very incredible work like Balanchine's work, and this work, Petite Mort, by Killian. It's phenomenal. And we have a stager. Again, Elka Sheppers is her name, who is someone who was with Yuri Killian in the 17, 18 years that he was directing and creating on Netherlands Dance Theater. So, again, we have a stager who had direct contact. And actually, this ballet, Petite Mort, was created on her. So she did one of the six couples. She was one of the original artists when it was first done in 1991 for the Strasbourg Festival, which was celebrating the 200th anniversary of Mozart's death.
There's a lot of anniversaries and things in ballet, I've noticed.
It's good to recognize those things. Otherwise, you know, they start to become things we forget. So it's always good to recognize those landmark moments.
Yeah. Third on the bill, The Uneven. Now, that is Matthew Neenan's piece. What would you like to say about it? It was original. It's your original.
Yes, it's music to Philip Glass, cello and violin concerto. It's a new score of his that he composed in 2011.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like a new sound for Glass. It has that beautiful like repetition that he loves to use. It gets very quiet in areas, and then it gets very bombastic. But really some beautiful melodies and beautiful sounds in there. When I first heard it, I remember I was just going through. I was looking for a string orchestra for this work, and I can't even remember how I came across it, and I didn't even realize it was Philip Glass. Usually you can really tell what his music. But with this score, I was like, oh my God, it's Glass. and then approached Devin and Ramona, who's the musical director at the ballet, that I really wanted to use this score, and we made it happen. But a lot of my work in the last year has been just in response to our political and social climate. I even did a work for Ballet X last year that was probably much more literal and in your face and a little disturbing. I didn't want to do that for Kansas City Ballet, but all of the scenarios that have been going on in the past year, you just kind of, as an artist, I feel like you have to want to talk about it in your own abstract way. So this is definitely a ballet. There's, you know, I'm only saying this so people get an idea. If you saw the ballet and didn't know that this was my sense from the beginning, you wouldn't know, like, oh, this is about, like, what we're going through. Or maybe you would. I don't know. There's definitely hints of competition and dancers against each other and then finding their way towards each other. But I really, it's still in the end in response to the music.
Mm-hmm. But it is, what I love about the work is that it's a hopeful outcome.
Yes.
Your response.
For sure.
That your statement is that there is hope, that we have, you know, that we as a community, you know, we can overcome.
We can.
And come back together. And that's what I love about the work, is that it's very optimistic and very, it gives you a sense of hope.
Yeah.
Which I really appreciate that about the work, Matthew.
No,
I really
do. A part of your anniversary celebration Sunday night.
Oh,
you have a special event.
Sunday night, super Sunday. It's amazing. It's free. So, you know, I hope your audience has heard that. It's free. And all you got to do is go online to get tickets, reserve a seat. But it's a chance for us to really look back over the entire 60-year history of Kansas City Ballet and recognize these different incredible eras that have occurred in this evolution of this 60-year-old arts institution here in Kansas City, which is important. Like I was saying earlier, it's important to recognize these moments with Tatiana Dugadovska and then with Todd Bolander's time period, and then with Bill Whitener's time period, and then, you know, I'm kind of the new kid on the block. I've only been here 5 years. I feel like I'm still just a kid compared to these other icons that have led this company in the past. Bill Whitener will actually be in the audience with us, which is exciting to have him back.
That's
great. Really excited about that. And, you know, we're going to see a lot of video over the course of this one-hour show, just looking at the past. Then we're going to have a great opportunity to see the future with dancers. Parrish Maynard, our ballet master, has created a work, about a 10-minute work, that is choreographed on members of the school. And it's going to speak to the future, because these kids that are going to perform are the ones that will be company members. You know, between 9 and 15 years from now, you're going to see some of these children will be what the company is made of. And that's important, to not only recognize the past, but then look to the future, because if we don't, you know, we stagnate. So it's always important to be moving forward. And that's another reason, and I have to say this, I'm going to take a divergent moment. That's another reason why Matthew Neenan is on the program, is because there's always a need to continue to investigate and discover the future of dance. And choreographers like Matthew are vital to our art form, because they are looking ahead and pioneering the way forward in what what kind of movement we're going to be doing and what we're going to talk about on stage. And, you know, that's why works like Matthew and then also on the other weekend, Andrea Shermalee's work, both in our world premieres. So as well, that's another brand new work, and that's important to have. Yeah, so it's a big night, that 60th anniversary Sunday night.
Yeah, let's move on to the next weekend, and I've only left 6 minutes, so they're going to get short shrift, and I'm sorry about that. We have so many interesting things to talk about. The Man in Black, done to the music of Johnny Cash.
Yeah. Man in Black is a work by James Cadelco. It was first done in 2010 for Ballet Met in Columbus, Ohio, and it's a work done to six songs of Johnny's Cash's work. They're from the American series that were done much later in his life when he was much, much, much older. It's like a couple years before he died, and there's this sense of grit and gravel in his voice that you don't find in his earlier works, and I really like that sense of time and wisdom that's in his voice. And it's four dancers on stage. They're on stage for 25 minutes. They never leave the stage, four of them. They do these six songs, and they're very interdependent on each other, and it's very much a commentary on you know, the common person, you know, if I could say it that way, or, you know, are the people who make this country happen, let me put it that way, that are on the ground doing the work. You could call it the blue collar people. You know, it's the everyday person, and it's the struggles of their lives that is performed out by these four dancers, and they're all in right off the shelf cowboy boots. And it's really interesting to see what the choreography does when you're limited by the flexibility of boots. It's not like you're wearing ballet shoes, so it's very different. And you actually hear the shoes on stage. The choreographer chose to make the shoes actually a part of a fifth cast member because you actually get them in sync using the shoes. It's very, it's a really interesting work. I really enjoy it.
Yeah. Klein Perspectives.
Klein Perspectives. That's another, her work by Andrea Shermalee. That's a world premiere. Beautiful work. Done to a variety of music with some soundscaping in the middle of it, electronic soundscaping to blend some sections of the music. Her work is about communication and miscommunication in the society we live in today. So there's a bit of a common theme between Matthew and Andrea's work, which is fascinating. They did not talk to each other about this, and it's just, you know, artists today are really wanting to make a statement, and I think it's really interesting that Andrea has come up with this work. And she spent a lot of time with Netherlands Dance Theater, where Yuri Killian was the director and choreographer. And it's fascinating to have Yuri Killian's work on the first weekend and then have Andrea's work on the second weekend, and really look at the influence that Yuri Killian had on Andrea's creative process. She has her own complete voice choreographically, but it's quite interesting to see how we are informed in what we experienced in our past. And it's a really cool work. I'm going to enjoy seeing it on stage.
And finally, Play
by Stanton Welsh. That's to the music of Moby. Awesome music. Oh my goodness. I just totally went off the deep end and bought all sorts of albums of his when I saw it in 2010. I first saw it done. My goodness, it's really cool music. And it's very urban in feeling. And it's inspired, the ballet's inspired by Stanton Welsh, the choreographer's time when he was living in New York City, and how, you know, we can kind of lose ourselves in a big city. There's a lot of anonymity as you walk down the street in New York. And there's a lot of disconnect in terms of relationships when you're in that kind of serious, heavy-duty, urban sort of environment. And it's a really interesting commentary on that kind of lifestyle. You know, relationships come and go, like they don't mean anything in this ballet. So there's a lot of commentary about that in the work. And it, again, it'll close that program, and it's one of those works that really has a good, strong statement about society.
Sure.
And, you know, art replicates and comments on our real lives, and I think it's really interesting how many of the works on this program do just that.
Yeah, two weekends of shows. Never done that before.
That's
three
right.
The first week, Three the second week. Mm-hmm. Beginning on April the 6th, Friday the 6th at 7:30, Saturday the 7th at 7:30, Sunday the 8th, a matinee at 2 o'clock p.m. first weekend, second weekend, Friday the 13th at 7:30, yep. Saturday the 14th at 7:30, Sunday the 15th.
Mm-hmm. And I had one other thing I wanted to tell you about. The first weekend is all three of the pieces on the program are done with a live orchestra, the Kansas City Symphony. The second weekend is all recordings because all of that music is more contemporary with things like Johnny Cash.
Oh, sure. Well, you'd want to hear actual Johnny Cash music and voice.
Yeah.
To hear that would make it more authentic for you.
It would, though I don't think Johnny could come and do the show.
You never know. You might want to. But boy, six great ballets covering two weekends. KCBallet.org for more information, or you can call 816-931-8993. All the performances at the new Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. And as I often say, you have to thank the Kauffmans. A lot of things in Kansas City wouldn't be here. That new facility wouldn't be here. The Royals probably would not be here. Right. Mr. Kauffman put the Royals as an expansion team out and we probably wouldn't have the Royals or that building if it weren't for the Kauffman family. So big thanks to them and Julia Kauffman, who remains with us. And of course, I wanted to ask Matthew before you left. Ballet X, it sounds like you meant it to be more cutting edge ballet. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Ballet X. The main goal is to it's just producing new choreography all the time. The company usually premieres about 7 to 8 works, different works a year, with like 7 to 8 choreographers. Mm-hmm. It's a lot, but the company now is touring quite a bit, and they're like in their prime.
Do they have a website for people
they
to check
them out? They do, ballet.org.
Okay. Oh, well, that's simple to remember.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, enjoy your time in Kansas City.
Thank you
very much. Success
Thank you
with
for
the
having me.
New version of The Uneven, part of the first weekend of shows on the 60th anniversary. Is that a Diamond Jubilee? I guess it probably is.
It's
a Diamond Jubilee weekend beginning coming up this Friday, April 6th. Presentation of the Kansas City Ballet, kcballet.org. Thanks so much for being with us. Devin Carney, the artistic director of the Kansas City Ballet, has been putting in a lot of work on ballet.
We are. Thank you, Michael.
And Matthew Neenan, guest choreographer. He's doing The Uneven, but does things all over the country. All of that. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
For being with us today. That's all coming up the next two weekends, by the way. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we're going to talk about some cutting edge things. The Fish Tank Performance Studio and Heidi Van will be with us when we return. You're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI 90.1 FM. And welcome back to the Arts Magazine show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Going to journey on down to the Fish Tank Performing Arts Studio. Did I get it right this time?
It's just called Fish Tank Theater.
Okay.
Yeah.
What other
Keeping
time,
it simple.
Fish what
Tank
other time
Theater.
You came, it was longer.
Yes. Now we are Fish Tank Theater, a nomadic theater company, making theater anywhere but expected, and we'll be at La Esquina. So we'll be at a Charlotte Street space presenting our newest production.
Yeah, and that would be the Belfast Girls. It was identified, I looked it up online,
cool.
Heidi. It was identified as experimental theater.
Well, the Fish Tank presents contemporary experimental live theater. The Belfast Girls is a script that was written, and it's, historical. So it's not necessarily experimental.
If I didn't introduce her properly, that's the voice of Heidi Van, the artistic director, also known as the curator for the Fish Tank Theater. And so I guess you are sponsoring, because it's not in your space this time. It's, as you said,
as I said,
La Esquina.
Yeah, so we are performing in La Esquina, which is at 1000 West 25th Street. It is a white box gallery space that is run and curated by the Charlotte Street Foundation, who granted Fish Tank Theater the opportunity to perform in their space. As I mentioned earlier, the Fish Tank, we are a nomadic theater company, and for the past 2 years, we've been presenting theater in different spaces around the town. So hopefully you're used to seeing us in alternative venues and performance nooks in Kansas City. And one of the reasons why I wanted to do the show at La Esquina is because Belfast Girls is about young women leaving Ireland to go to Australia in the Earl Grey Irish immigrant orphan scheme. And I wanted to build a boat. And so that's why I did it in Oskina.
There was, I viewed when I was viewing online a part of the Arts Upload show with Randy Mason mm-hmm. that was on Channel 19. So I viewed that again. Mm-hmm. And that reminded me once again of all that you do down there. All the way from performing in the window. He had a nice piece of you performing in mm-hmm. the window, which you do. Mm-hmm. Then you're downstairs. And then you're upstairs.
Right. Well, I'm not downstairs anymore. I'm just upstairs okay. In the rehearsal hall, production hall. But I have two friends with me here today.
Yeah, yeah. Let's
well.
Tell us who they are.
Well, we have Rashidat Raz Badajo.
Hi.
She is playing the role of Judith in Belfast Girls, and another actress from the show, Caitlin Gould, who plays the role of Ellen.
Hello.
Okay. Hello, Caitlin. G-O-U-L-D, I'm guessing.
That's right.
And
right.
Rashidat, I didn't get your last name at all.
Badajo.
Okay.
B as in boy, A as in apple, D as in David, E as in Edward, J as in John, O as in olive, Badajo.
Badajo. Well, thank you. Thank you for being here with us. You have roles. You are two of the Belfast girls, I take
yes.
it?
Yeah.
Yeah. That headed, it was what, about 1850, I'm going to guess,
yeah.
heading from Ireland to Australia for what? Resettling, starting a new life. What was the reason behind that?
Repopulation of Australia.
Repopulation.
Like, mm-hmm. So pretty much we play prostitutes, hey. And we, like, so pretty much the government of Ireland came up with this whole idea of being able to make a deal with Australia to export people, mm-hmm. Like cattle, weirdly enough. For the sake of repopulating Australia, because in Australia at the time the colony only had men, so they're like, well,
yeah, they sent all their convict men over there, and then they were like, wait a second, we this isn't working out very well. So then,
pull the Caitlin, pull it a little closer to you. Yeah, you mentioned that it was a colony where they sent prisoners, so they would send women over there as
right.
well.
Yeah, I think the idea behind this scheme was more so to. In a sense, they thought they were providing famine relief, but also they were getting rid of their poor and unwanted women, mm-hmm. essentially.
Yeah. Well, boy, there was, what, how many of you? Was there eight?
In the show, in this production, there are five characters that are featured in this particular show. But throughout the course of this scheme by Earl Grey to send women to Australia, about 4,000 women made passage from the Irish famine to Australia. And they said, like, to Australia that these were orphan girls. They were under 19 and they were pure as the driven snow. And not many of those things were true ever. And so this play is set against the backdrop of the Irish famine, and these women get passage to go on this boat. And throughout the play, which is their journey from embarking Belfast to arriving in Australia, they think that they are going to make a fresh start, manifest destiny, that they will be able to take their lives and futures into their own hands. And during the journey, some secrets are unraveled and information is passed around, and they become awakened and politicized and activated and determined throughout this journey.
Why not start a new life? What's the matter with that?
I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. The difference is the church lied to these women. So mm-hmm. they are thinking that we're getting famine relief. But in reality, the church uses as an opportunity to purge the country of its dirty women, air quotes, on that. So,
well, when the church went to religionize, my word, Australia, they were just starting all over again.
For them, yeah.
Not a good idea at all, I don't think.
Yeah, well, we had a discussion a couple of weeks ago that we partnered with the Irish Center of Kansas City, and we had some amazing Irish literary scholars there with us that illuminated even us. You know, at this time in Ireland, it was very dire, and they were exporting cattle and grain, and the people inside the country who were working these fields were starving, and then the workhouses were becoming full, and the poorhouses were becoming full, and one of the speakers talked about like extreme poverty and what choices do you have? And in this case, the choice of the government was to, you know, call Australia, where they had been sending other undesirables, mm-hmm. I imagine we could call them that. And, you know, it was before people were really making passage to America, because that was kind of a different journey. Going to America was a lot different than going to Australia. Mm-hmm. So that's why this play is so exciting, because it has this really rich political tumultuous backdrop that isn't so different from the way that some countries are functioning today, and this choice that people are making to leave or to get passage or to go somewhere where they think that their lives will be better, can be better. They get there and they find that it's a very different reality. And you know, as producing artistic director of the Fish Tank, this play really resonated with me. For many reasons. One, it has five very, very strong female characters, and they're very brave in making this choice to get on the boat to go. And as we saw with people coming across, you know, many rough waters in rafts with babies and, you know, their families, that people are still making this journey. And so that's what I hope that this play highlights, that we need to welcome people.
Did the ladies know what they were getting into completely?
Not really.
No.
Not really.
Not at all. They were also, I think it's important to remember that these were Irish Catholic, and this was during under the British rule, and they essentially had no rights whatsoever. So part of it was desperation, but part of it was, I mean, what choice did they have? And then it I guess, is revealed, you know, they're not wanted where they're mm-hmm. going. So I think that's another important thing that still resonates with me, and something that I think is relevant today.
Not wanted where they're coming from, right, and both. Not knowing, both. Not wanted where they're going either.
Yeah.
That's a no-win situation for you.
So, yeah, what do you do? I mean, it's a rich ground, feeding ground for drama and for these different characters in the play. So I know that we're talking about about the historical backdrop, but that's just like the grease in the pan that's sizzling, you know, and then you kind of have these characters inside, and what do they do with that? How, like, you know, do they become more committed? Do they give up? What is their resolve? It's a really cool play.
It's an amazing play.
It was written by Jackie McCarrick.
Yes.
Who is amazing.
Kind of a follow-up to Leopoldville. Was Leopoldville her first play?
She has written many, many plays, and she has been very open in communication and support of our production and offering assistance and, you know, dramaturgical help, as well as helping us, like, figure out some things that we were confused about or aren't as aware of being Americans and not Irish citizens. Also, she made sure that the Irish Cultural Center of Kansas City knew that we were doing the play. Like, a lot of the world has become very small with social media and all of that, that she's been also very excited about her play being done in America. And we're a regional premiere of Belfast Girls and possibly like the fifth production of it in America, but she is delighted and inspired how Americans are resonating with the themes and stories happening are taking place within the story of Belfast Girls.
Yeah, you ladies, you're not only doing the show here, you're doing it or have done it in other places and will be doing it in others as well, no?
Just
that's the impression I had from reading the blurb about it, because it said it was moving on to, did it say Portland after
that? Well, it's going to be produced in other places, not with this particular company, but probably as it was written that it's moving on. And actually the first production of it in Australia mm-hmm. will take place soon. It's interesting, you know, you go through and you do plays a lot, but this one, it's like we're connected. All the playwright has now connected companies of various productions of Belfast Girls, and we're all kind of excited for each other. Like, yeah. She posted this picture about, you know, of these Australian girls that are going to do the story of Belfast Girls, which is also very different because they're like descendants of Belfast girls who came over to Australia. So, yeah.
Yes, they would be. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So, no, this is just an extremely localized production.
Yeah. Well, I just had that impression. I looked at the McCarrick website. Yeah. She was talking about all the various performances that she was doing. So she's getting a lot of good...
And it's going to be a movie. She just wrote a screenplay.
Oh, it's so cinematic. And it's super cinematic. Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm.
And so it all takes place on the ship during the voyage?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Talk about our boat.
Okay, the boat is awesome. Mark Exline, our scenic designer, is a genius, honestly. Like, I think...
He's incredible.
Him and Heidi getting together will always equal amazing productions, hands down. So this is going to be the first production that's actually done with hammocks instead of, like, traditional bunk beds. Uh-huh. So I am phobic of hammocks, but... when it comes down to actually doing it and the way that he's constructed the whole entire thing, it's a real boat. It has a bottom level and a top level. We have a deck. It's a boat.
A mast.
Yeah. Like, the audience, how they'll be sitting, you'll feel like you're on this journey with us on this boat.
Does it move?
No. I wish. Oh.
You wish. Move.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, that sounds very realistic. What kinds of things did the laser? It's got long. How long would that take? Six, 9 months?
2-3 months.
Oh, I would have thought longer in 1850.
I guess depending on the currents.
So they went from Ireland to Australia. So I assume they went down and around.
Right, because they stop off in Plymouth for a minute, and then from there they go. They pass by Portugal, and they finally reach Australia.
Yeah, so a lot of time for a lot of conversation, reflection, and stories. What kinds of things do you share with each other?
Danger.
What does Judith do? What does she find on that boat?
Oh my gosh, what doesn't she find on this boat? I mean, like, Judith and I are very similar in the fact that we are very political when it comes to our current situation. Judith is different from the other girls because she isn't originally from Belfast. She was an orphan from Kingston, Jamaica, and she got adopted by oyster catchers. And so she grew up learning how to shuck oysters, and then she escaped that and headed to Belfast. And then with kind of like the same reason the women are heading to Australia, in with hopes of finding a place where they can belong and thrive. But they don't find that. So, but what she discovers, one of the other characters on board, Molly, brings on all of these books, and Judith is a heavy reader. And so she reads the Communist Manifesto, and like, this is 2 years after it came out. And so it's like, wow, what's happening? So she tries to radicalize the people on the boat to like, in hopes of when we reach Australia, that we won't have to go through famine again. Uh-huh. So that's a really huge discovery for her.
Yeah. There's a lot of conversation about who let this happen and how it happened. And what's interesting is how the characters all respond to that as well.
Yeah. And Jackie McCarrick, what was her motivation behind that? She wanted to expose this particular thing that was happening because it really happened.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. They really did send young ladies down there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was that the purpose of her writing the play, do you think?
I think it was... Wasn't there a quote in that interview she gave where it was like no one had written this play and she was doing research, I believe, mm-hmm. and found information about it and was like, I guess I'm going to be the one to write this play, more or less.
Mm-hmm. My favorite is that she said no one else had written it and no one else would. You know? Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, we learned at the Irish Center, we learned that there's a lot of shame when it comes to thinking about the things that occurred in the famine. And so the idea of talking about it in length or in detail is not typically done with Irish people, apparently. Yeah. And so I guess the fact that Jackie was like, well, I'm going to do it is amazing. But also throughout this whole entire thing that occurred with the famine, the people of Ireland, their population hasn't recovered since. Mm. which is insane to think about.
Oh, there's a lot of shame associated with Irish culture in general, being part Irish myself. I hear things all
what
the time
hear,
about
what
that.
What do you hear?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't want to generalize, but the proclivity to overindulge in beverages, major problem. Has caused, and of course, the continuing battle that's gone on forever in Ireland with the British. On for a long time.
Yeah, how does Ellen feel about the Englishmen?
Oh, ew. Which is, Caitlin's boyfriend is British, but Ellen hates any British man ever. Yeah. It just makes me think of, because my partner is British, and so we have a friend who's Irish. Hi, Scott, if you're listening. And he used to make, Ryan, my boyfriend, used to make jokes to Scott about the potato famine. And I never really understood. And I'd be like, oh, okay, whatever. And Scott was like, it's actually very serious. And the British really, like, messed us up and everything. And I didn't get it. Mm-hmm. And then we started working on this play. And I was like, oh, my God. Yes, they did. Like, this was all manufactured. There's a really good documentary I watched that talks about how, like, this has been, the British, like, kind of set the Irish up to fail from, like, the early 1800s when they became, and then when they imperialized, I don't know if it's the correct word, but when they took over Ireland, essentially. And it just, I mean, they squeezed them out of all of their resources, and it just made it horrible for them. And then the potato famine happened, and what could they do? Mm-hmm. It's really sad.
And the thing that also resonates with me when I think about that whole situation during that time, the potato failed, but all the other crops were fine. They were shipping out their cattle and grain while their people were starving.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what, that something they also said in the talk, too, is instead of calling it the famine, calling it the hunger. Mm-hmm. And then there's another quote at the top of the play by another playwright that had something to do with that one. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But it's like you can't starve people when there's food to be had. And so it's just what is interesting about this play, as, and I think what also attracts Americans to it or anyone to it, is like this other history that is just like under the rug, that just like you lift up the rug and then you just have to keep lifting it up and you're like, oh my goodness, what is this? And you're following, you know, stories, narratives, you're finding documents and timelines and population charts. I was a history poli-sci major in college, so this fascinates me to no end. But also to put I'm going to use the word gentle, but like to put a gentle narrative over it. So it's like you're not sitting there for 2 hours getting a history lecture. Like the way that the characters discover the circumstance is the way that you as an audience member are also like awakened to be like, whoa, like you put the pieces together themselves about how this scheme was organized and the participants weren't fully aware. And, I think a lot of people can put on that sort of situation that's like you follow a leader and you believe what they say and then something else happens and you realize, oh, I fell for that. Yeah. Like I believed that. I believed that somebody had my best interest in when it really wasn't. There was something that Jackie said in that article. I could not believe that elected leaders could sabotage the lives of their citizens. And, Judith has a line in the play that says, a country that lets their young die like that isn't a country I want to be in. And like, shock, resonance, resonance, resonance. There's a lot of things. There's a lot of things happening in a lot of countries, especially the one I'm sitting in right now, that you're just like, what are we? What do we stand for? And what play is going to be written about us 150 years from now, and what are we going to be like?
I don't even want to imagine.
So it's interesting for me as a, artistic director, a curator of work, someone who selects the shows that go into my season, to come across a play like this, which I did over a year ago, and was like, this is the next thing we're doing. This is the next big thing that we're doing, and we're doing it in grand style, and you shouldn't miss it. It's April 7th is when we open, which is this Saturday. We went run through April 29th, and it is at La Esquina, which is 1000 West 25th Street. It's the corner of Bellevue and Southwest Boulevard. It's right down from Taqueria Mexico, around the corner from Boulevard Brewery. You know where it is. I know the address might confuse you, but believe me, Kansas City, you know where it is. It's a robin's egg blue-colored building. And you can find out you know, how to reserve your ticket at fishtanktheater.com. Fishtank Theater, R-E. .com. And we'll run Wednesdays through Sundays. Showtimes during the week and weekend are 8 p.m., except Sundays are at 3. And you're not going to want to miss it. Set design by Mark Exline, projections by Shane Rouse. It's beautiful.
So fishtanktheater.com. Now, La Esquina. It's Southwest Boulevard, not the traffic way, folks. Southwest Boulevard. And it's a quick ride about what would be 25th Street?
About what would be 25th Street.
Is it before or after the railroad underpass?
Before.
Okay. I mean, before, if you're coming from the east, mm-hmm. it's before. If you're coming from the west, it's after.
Good point.
So, but don't be afraid of the location because you don't know what it is or haven't been there. Mm-hmm. A lot of things happen at La Esquina in the visual art and also music performance world. It doesn't host a lot of theater, but it's a beautiful space to host theater. So that's why I applied to be part of their curatorial season, because I've seen many compelling things in there, dioramas and other performance events. But La Esquina is a space managed by the Charlotte Street Foundation, which is a champion of artists in Kansas City. So check it. We're featured on their website, too.
Mm-hmm. La Esquina, 1000 West 25th Street. If you MapQuest things, you need that zip code 64108. And go online to Fishtank Theater with an R-E, as Heidi said, .com for more information on all of that. I want to thank you all for being here as we nearly run out of time again. Notice how fast things go.
It goes so fast.
It does. It does for me as well. Heidi Van, the producing artistic director and curator. Should I still use theater? Should I just drop?
You can just drop it.
I can just drop. I will drop theater of the Fish Tank theater. Going on. Okay. And here's the part I dread.
Rashida Raz Badajo.
Okay. Thank you very much for being here. I apologize for not getting Caitlin Gould.
Thank you.
I can say that one. Thank you so much. Two of the actresses in the show Belfast Girls opening this Saturday, April 7th at, I didn't get the time, about 7:30?
8 p.m.
8 p.m. at La Esquina, 1000 West 25th Street. And I'm sure there are things going on at the Fish Tank as well. Coming up, same website, same information.
Well, that's what we're doing. We're going to be at La Esquina, so that's where we will be.
Okay.
So, yes. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us. Yeah. That's starting this Saturday, the 7th. The Jazz Insider, Sam Wiseman, is next. He's going to be playing some great jazz for you this afternoon. Jazz from 1 to 3, the blues from 3 to 6, right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that crossing the road, I'm Michael Hogue. We'll see you next time.